Good to be with you guys. Feels like it's been a while. I mean, we were just up here last week, but that was like not really a sermon. And honestly, I was thinking with the last service, I still feel a little rusty coming back in, so bear with me. But it's sure good to be back with you guys, and we missed you. It's an interesting experience to leave for a time and then come back. And it actually... It affords some sort of unique opportunities for growth, quite honestly. Most of us, you know, we're like so caught up and enmeshed in our lives, and so to pull yourself out for a second allows you to kind of get a good look at yourself. That typically it's easy for us to focus on ourselves based on sort of outward things that we do or, you know, relationships that we have, tasks we perform that give us a sense of value. And when you strip all that away, it's just you, right? You're like not Pastor Jeff. You're just Jeff for 3 months. And I did enjoy sabbatical. I was like, oh, I could just keep doing this, right? Like something kind of nice about when you hit that sort of groove. And yet, when it comes to calling, when it comes to who I am, who I'm made to be, so much of that is about us. It's about something that comes out when we are together. And this is how we're designed to be. I am teaching a class this semester on systems theory, and I find it so fascinating. And if you haven't, you're not familiar with systems theory, it's really seeing how necessarily interconnected we are. And I want to talk about that in just a sec. But before we do, I have a quick little announcement on back to school. So, I thought, you know, since it is this time and we are kind of entering into the fall and classes are beginning, I'm going to offer a quick little class for us starting September 11th, and it's going to be a three-week class, and we're going to go through a book called The Abolition of Man. And I read through it this summer and just loved it. To me, it is like such a foundational book because it's really talking about the nature of truth. And it's one of those things that, like, if you get that one wrong, sort of, it becomes real shaky what you build upon. But to understand that, this truth that calls us to something more, calls us to something larger. And so we're going to do that on Wednesday nights from 7 to 8:30 for anybody that's interested. 3 weeks, because it's a short, nice short little book. 38 pages, I think, is what it is. So, but let me warn you, it's not easy. So it's going to push you a little bit. But that's why we'll get together and discuss it. So if you've ever been like, oh, I want to take a crack at something of C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, September 11th, 18th, and 25th, and here's the clincher, is that I'm going to ask that you commit to all three, right? Not that there's going to be an attendance sheet, but when it comes down to it, like, love it if you're kind of going, yeah, I can do all three of those. So anyway, there's going to be a sign-up form with like a little QR code there in the back, and that'll take you to the website, just so I know how many people are coming, because if it's small, we'll just do it in my house. And if it's large, we'll do it in the fellowship hall. So there you go. For all of you that need one more thing to do, sign up. It's going to be awesome. And today, Travis mentioned that in the lectionary readings, we're going into the book of James. And I love James, maybe one of my favorite books of all, and on one of my favorite topics of all, which is wisdom. And wisdom to me, I think, as I look at our world today, I think wisdom is the thing that is lacking. Where are the wise ones? Where are the sages? And James, this is kind of his burden as he sees an early church splintered and factioned and struggling with the complexities of the gospel. James is making this call to wisdom. Paul is going to be the advocate for grace. But James is going to wave this flag of wisdom and say it matters not just what we believe, but what we do. Not what we hear, but how we act. That there's a sort of inner working and then an outward manifestation of that. And if it's not producing that sort of fruit, then maybe something is not happening internally correct. So our passage today, it begins with this beautiful verse that we've all heard quoted. It gets sewn onto pillows like, every good and perfect gift comes from the Father of lights. And we look at that and we think, oh yeah, I just love the beauty of God. And we picture these sort of glorious sunsets, right? These beautiful moments. And maybe forget that he's talking about trials. He's talking about difficulties. And saying these gifts are the things that teach us how to be wise, how to persevere, and ultimately how to become like Jesus. So let me read our verses for today. James 1, 17 through 27. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. By his own choice he gave us birth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. My brothers and sisters, understand this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For human anger does not accomplish God's righteousness. Therefore, ridding yourselves of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, humbly receive the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Because if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like someone looking at his own face in a mirror, for he looks at himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of person he was. But the one who looks intently into the perfect law of freedom and perseveres in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer who works, this person will be blessed in what he does. If anyone thinks he's religious without controlling his tongue, his religion is useless, and he deceives himself. Pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. This is the word of the Lord. Now, I mentioned kind of as sort of a setup that I'm like in this class on systems theory. And this is what I love about systems theory, is it pays attention really to two things. It pays attention to how the health of us, how we're doing, and then reminds us that the way that we grow healthier is through our own inner work. But if I want to change the health of whatever system I'm a part of, if it's my family, if it's my community, if it's my church, if it's a classroom, if it's whatever this is that I'm in, if I want to change it, the way I change it is by my own health and my own growth. By looking inward, it helps me manifest something that's going to affect outward growth. And they're discovering this in leadership. There's quite a lot that's written about it, but it's fascinating. And you realize that kind of the nature and fabric of reality is so much about systems, even us, right? If you understand our biology, we're just system after system after system, whether it's respiratory or autoimmune or cardiovascular, all these systems working together. And when they're working well, we forget about them, right? We're sort of oblivious to these systems until they start to fail. But that our life, our social worlds, all of these things are systems as well. And our behavior in that system is vital. In fact, Scripture is going to point to this idea. I think Paul does this so beautifully in 1 Corinthians, where he says, you, like as a church, are a system. And he says, just as a body, though one, has many parts, but all its many parts form one body, so it is with Christ. For we're all baptized by one body, by one spirit, to form one body, whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free. And we were all given the one spirit to drink. Even so, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. And Paul says this, and this is a beautiful picture. It's a wonderful metaphor. You know, we'd like to think he's just sort of in the classroom going, just so you know, the church is a body, right? But he's actually addressing problems that are going on. That it's our tendency to not function like a body. It's our tendency to praise certain organs and diminish others. It's a tendency of ours to not think of each other first, to not care for those that are struggling. Learning to think this way is kind of at the heart of the gospel, right? Because the gospel is saying we are meant to function as this like vastly inclusive, compassionate body of Christ, whether Jews or Gentiles, slaves or free. And this is what the gospel had done. It came and brought this good news in, which like tore down all those things of separation. But the church had to learn how to do this, and they struggled with it. They would do it for a time, and then they'd all kind of go back to their places of comfort and familiarity. That this gospel message, this good news, was a challenge to some of their natural inclinations. And without a level of work or growth, they weren't going to be able to uphold it. In thinking of our life, I mean, we tend to like to think of it with a measure of control, like it comes down to tactics and plans and strategy, when really our life and the health of our life is a matter of the relationships that we're in. It's that line, you're only as happy as your least happy child, right? That as a family, right? You can't just be happy and have one suffering, like you're connected. And Paul's going to hold that up for us and say it's the same thing for you. If one part of the body suffers, you all suffer. If one party celebrates, you all celebrate. So to me, I'm loving this because what it does, what systems theory teaches you to do, is to realize that if I want to change this system, I have to change me. It begins here. How much I would like it to be your fault, right? Because then I don't have to take responsibility. Who's the problem? That guy over there, right? Systems theory goes, oh, no, no, no. Like, this is all internal work. And how do I let that begin with me? And this is what I think James is really doing, is helping us understand, like, that as followers of Jesus, we are to be becoming wise. And that wisdom is felt in our systems. It's felt in our families. It's felt in our communities. It's felt in the health of our church. That if we're doing this work and we're becoming like Jesus, then our actions follow. And there's a texture that he's suggesting here. How do we behave? Well, we're quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. Think about that. How accurately does that describe your own heart? The book that I'm reading on this is by this guy, Edwin Friedman, and he's saying, we live in this world of so much anxiety, so much fear, that oftentimes the things that are coming out of our mouths are these reactions, the anger that all of a sudden lashes out, and our tendency to sort of not even be aware of ourselves when we do, right? We know this from our kids, because when our kids hit that, we describe it as they're flooded. Right? Have you heard that term? So much emotion that they're like not even aware of how it's behaving. And yet we too become flooded. We get caught up. And James, I think, is helping us sort of back off from these realities and pay attention. I always wish that we had a check engine light that would go off before we really lose it, right? Because most of us, we have a measure of patience. We're in those certain settings. We're like, I'm okay. And then we're like, oh, nope, too far. And then, boom, right? This thing comes out of us, right? The lion comes out. And you're like, where did that come from? And James is saying, God has created these gifts for you in order for you to become wise. That your life is these beautiful opportunities for you to grow. And God knows you so well. These are like perfect gifts, these trials. In fact, a few verses before this, he's going to say, consider it joy when you go through trials, when you're challenged in these areas. Why? Because this develops perseverance, develops endurance, develops this sort of grit, this deep inner calm. And that Jesus is the embodiment of this. Jesus is the one who is completely non-reactive. In fact, we see him constantly bringing the situation down. I learned this new phrase. Well, I heard it yesterday. I was watching Man City was playing West Ham yesterday. And Man City's just dominant, right? They're just this, you know, they don't make mistakes. Except that, like, after halftime, West Ham came out and I had fast break after fast break, turnover after turnover, and you could see Man City rattled, right? So Pep subs in this guy, Ilkay Gundogan. And if you know him, he's like a veteran. He's an older player. In fact, he was traded recently and just came back. They got one of their veteran players back. But in the midst of this, there's sort of this panic and they're falling apart, and all of a sudden Gundogan gets the ball and he like just stops. And the commentator says, Gundogan, imposing calm. And I was like, oh, I love that. Imposing calm. And this wisdom, right? I think in James, in some ways, he's going, this is what you do, that the wise impose calm. It's not a soft, just sort of like, ah. It comes in and is like, shh, and brings the whole situation down. I think this is what good leaders do. But I think really in the end, it's what we're called to do. That all of us are a part of this body. All of us are called to wisdom. All of us are called to impose calm. But it doesn't just come naturally to us. And we have to pay attention when we fall short. Pay attention when we get flooded. Pay attention when we become reactive. Catch ourselves, right? You're in that conversation and somebody's talking and what are you thinking about? You're thinking about what you're about to say next. Like, this is what I want to say, right? And James is going, no. Right? There needs to be space inside of yourself to really listen. And how do we develop that space? James is going to talk about it, paying attention to our desires, paying attention to our sins, paying attention to our time and how we spend that time. But that the wise leader looks in the mirror and remembers. Stares at that and doesn't blame, doesn't find somebody else to be the problem, but takes and owns that for himself. Now, I don't know if you're like this. I sure like to blame. I sure like to find somebody else to hold responsible when things aren't working. It's them. That's the bad apple. Right? And I also kind of like to be the victim. It's like, it's not my fault. I'd fix that if I could, but gosh, I'm kind of helpless in this, you know. And James is saying, you have control over the thing that matters most. Your heart. Pay attention to it and do the work. Look in the mirror and develop an appetite for truth. Real truth. Not just the convenient truths. Not the stories that we like to spin about ourselves. Take a hard look in the mirror. It always makes me think, I've got these two pictures from this time I went on this surf trip to Costa Rica. And if you ask me, this is how I surf, not that. Right? Jeff, how do you surf? I'm the guy on the left, not the guy on the right. Right? And yet, what we would do on this trip is be filmed all day long, and then we would sit and go through footage of ourselves surfing. And I would just sweat the whole time. It was like so painful, right? I'm thinking, this is the way the wave felt, but what really helps me get better? What helps so that there's more of these? It's like paying attention to all the things I'm doing wrong. Noticing, right? And like you're watching yourself and you're thinking, oh my gosh, I thought I looked so good on that wave, and my shoulders are all weird and my stance is all wrong, and like I should have been extended when I was crouching and vice versa. I'm not turning my hips, like all the things. And the truth is, you go, do you want to get better? Then you watch the footage. Do you want to improve? Do you want to grow? And I think as James is writing this letter, this is his words to his church. And really that question, and I think it's a wonderful question for us today, do you want to grow? Or do you kind of think you've got this figured out? Or you know what? I've grown enough. Right? That when it comes down to it, I mean, this is something that I learned from Friedman, is he's going to say, if you want to be an effective leader, then you have to want to grow. The second you're like, I think I'm done, you start losing your effectiveness. It's never over. And I think in some ways that's what James is getting at. Do you want to be wise? Then you want to grow. In fact, he's going to say earlier that if you ask for wisdom, God gives it generously. In fact, I think sometimes he's given it to us generously when we don't ask for it. But inviting us to see it, inviting us to lean in to the work he's doing. James is going to say, consider it joy. when life gets hard. Consider it joy when you sit next to that frustrating coworker. Consider it joy when you get in an argument with a parent or with your child or whatever that is, right? This is an opportunity. This is a gift. A gift to grow. I remember when, what is her name? Duckworth wrote the book on growth mindset. I got that right? Angela Duckworth? And grit, she wrote grit. And you're saying that, like, when you show up to class, the kids that succeed are the ones that go, oh, I was hoping this was going to be hard. Oh, I was hoping this was going to be a challenge. And I think, I love this when James talks, because he's like, this is not easy, but you want this. It's worth going for. It's worth pushing for. And the good news is this work is not like some sort of temporary improvement. James says, what comes with this is not just wisdom. It comes with this crown of life. And I love how he takes and he puts, like Paul does so often as well, puts our trials on this eternal continuum and goes, in the long run, the light and momentary afflictions become this weight of glory. That the persevering leads to a crown of life. That it all happens on this eternal scale. And what you get to keep from this life is your heart, right? That's Willard says this. He says, what you give to God is your heart, and what he gives to you is your heart. That in this work, there's a refining and a freedom that's happening, an enlarging of our capacity to love. That as we do, we're gaining the ability to become more and more and more like our example, more and more and more like Jesus. James refers to this seed planting is becoming in us this opportunity to be like Christ, the first fruit. And I think forever when I hear first fruit, we'll think of one of Greg's messages where he brought out this blood orange and he was talking about the first fruit is the beginning. It's the first indicator of what the rest of the season is going to be like. So how is the rest of the harvest going to taste? Take a bite of the first fruit. And Jesus comes out, and Jesus is not just the one who goes before it or does the heavy lifting for us. He's the one who models it, but then becomes the indicator of what our life is to be like. Of course this is going to take time. That's the standard. And yet what is the gift? Jesus is saying, I'm going to turn your heart to be more and more and more like mine. And one of the ways this happens is in the midst of these systems and in the midst of the conflicts that occur. It happens relationally. And as we practice in these situations, we have this invitation to grow. But it takes work. James talks in this passage about our desires and our appetites and how those things just tend to lead us astray. And we want to throw up our hands like, gosh, the temptation is just too great. And he's saying, no, those desires can actually be shaped and molded. And in fact, this is where spiritual discipline comes in. That those desires, if those temptations are too great, we need to like back up a step and start working on the things underneath all of that. I've used this example I heard this in a talk one time where a guy was talking about how he just would walk by this spot that sold pornography and he could just like unavoidably he would just get sucked into this world and he's like, God, what am I supposed to do? But I have to walk by this on the way to work. And he said he got this great piece of advice where somebody told him, well, like just a block before that, what if you went right and then left and then left and then right and just avoid that spot? And the guy speaking said he met that guy years later and the guy said, I'm still going right and then left and then left and then right. That we could come in and through our actions start shaping these desires. Avoiding the sin that entangles us. Avoiding the thing that has become so repetitious and has got a hold of us. That it's not enough to just throw up our hands and say we're powerless over these things. James is telling us you can shape those desires and it happens over time. And it's not just what we're avoiding, but what we're setting our minds on. how we're practicing this. I love how he says true religion is this. Like, care for the widows and the orphans. Go do that work that's not going to give any sort of reward. Why widows and orphans? They have nothing to give you in return. We all love sort of transactional work, right? Where we're like, I'm going to do something for you, and maybe there's a little side benefit. And like, widows and orphans have nothing to offer you. And he's like, go do that work. You want to shape your soul? Go do that. I read this summer a book by Lewis. It's called An Experiment in Criticism. I was kind of motivated to wade over into some of his more peripheral stuff, you know, and this one is a great one. I mean, Lewis is a literary critic. So in this, he's writing about developing like really good taste for literature. And he's going to kind of hold to this idea that like, if you want to enjoy great books, you have to read great books. And that it may not taste good at first. He says bad taste is a taste for bad books, right? Like, you just like bad books. It's kind of like, oh, I just love junk food, right? And you're like, well, you need to change your palate. And the way you're going to do that is maybe by avoiding some of those bad books and then eating things that are like good for you, the meaty sort of steak. And that takes work. I was thinking, Brothers Karamazov took me like 5 attempts to get through. I got stuck in the first 100 pages of that book over and over. And I'm like, oh, this is just labor. That book is so good. But man, it took some effort. I love this. Lewis says, the sure mark of an unliterary man is that he considers, I've read it already, to be a conclusive argument against reading a work. Those who read great works, on the other hand, will read the same work 10, 20, or 30 times during the course of their life. Now, I don't know about you. I think I've read Brothers Karamazov twice. Not nearly that many times. But this is the point, is that it, as a metaphor, right? He's saying, if you want to savor the deep goodness, you got to work at it. He says this, literary people are always looking for leisure and silence in which to read and do so with their whole attention. When they're denied such attentive and undisturbed reading, even for a few days, they feel impoverished. And again, think of this as a metaphor. This is not to turn you into a bunch of readers. This is instead to say the desires, the appetites, the longing for wisdom has to be formed in us. We have to practice it. We have to choose it. So James is saying it's not enough to hear this, right? And to hear it. He's saying you have to do it. You have to do it. If you don't do it, it's not going to do any good. You can know all the best diet techniques and not lose a single pound, right? You can know all the best workout regimens and not build any muscle. You have to do it. There's a quote that's attributed to Aristotle, which I'm not sure if it's actually him, but it's a great quote anyways. He says, "We are what we repeatedly do. Therefore, excellence is not an act, but a habit." Be doers of the word. Shape those desires, the sins that entangle us, the sort of bad tastes that we've developed. Part of this in becoming like Christ is to practice these things, setting our minds on what is good and pure and true. Now, what about suffering? Because suffering is a thread that weaves through all of this. And you know, we might go, yeah, I get it, like the challenges, right? God's giving us an opportunity for a challenge, but like every good and perfect gift is, you know, like, what about the things that shouldn't have happened? What about the real wounds? Or even worse, what about the evils of this world that we've encountered? Are you meaning to tell me that like God is not somehow to blame for that? Like how God at the very least allowed this thing? I'm supposed to just paint a silver lining around this and like be happy about it? And the truth is, it's more complex than that. James is going, you can trust God's heart, but you're like, but what about the thing that shouldn't have happened? I was watching this interview with Anderson Cooper and Stephen Colbert. Did anybody watch that? And there's this moment in there. I love it partly because Colbert is going to quote Tolkien, which makes me happy. But but Anderson Cooper, he says, he's quoting from something, and he's asking Colbert this. He says, "You wrote that you've learned to love the thing that you most wished had not happened." And then he's about to ask the next question. He sort of stumbles over it, right? Because you see this flash of emotion. And you're like, oh, like, there's some layers filled back here. They're talking about grief. You have learned to love the thing that you most wished had not happened. And then he says, you went on to say, what punishments of God are not gifts? And then he says, do you really believe that? And you get this sense of like a holy moment, like how can that be the case? And Colbert goes, like with pause, he says, yes. And then he goes on to explain, I don't wish those things had happened. I wish still that they had not happened. But what he realizes, whatever that is, the loss or the pain or the struggles, that has created in him this deep capacity for empathy. And he's saying, if suffering is just human, and if that's the case, then for me to have the ability to enter into another's suffering, to have that empathy, this is a whole nother level of wisdom. It's a whole nother level of what God is up to in us. And you know that if you've been in the midst of real fear, that when somebody enters in that and knows your pain, they almost don't need to say anything. Just that level of empathy and understanding is profound. And see, God's going like, you're my team on the field, right? You are the ones imposing the calm. And how do you do that when you are in a world where there's brokenness and there's suffering? You do this with this deep understanding. That wisdom is not just something you've heard about, it's something that you've lived through. In fact, it's something that you've become. Your heart has been transformed. Your heart is resembling more and more Christ, who is the ultimate picture of non-anxious presence. Like we said, whatever situation Jesus walked in, he de-escalated, except maybe the money changers. He might have taken that one up a notch. But if it's a woman caught in adultery, he just starts like writing in the sand, like shh, and then responding with questions. Jesus had this way of responding to abuse without violence or retaliation, but with something so deeply profound, with grace. I love that scene with Peter where Peter's like, fight back, please. And Jesus is like, make no mistake, I could just wipe these guys out. It's not the plan. In other words, he's choosing that road to the cross. And some would say Jesus at the high point on the cross is when he turns amidst all the pain and accusation, all the insult and betrayal, and says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Meets all the sand, all the horror, all the like terrible cancer in the world, he meets it with this flood of grace. And this is what's being held up to us when we think about first fruits. Like that's the capacity that we're developing. That's what wisdom looks like when it manifests. And how closely does our heart match that? And here's the truth that when we become a Christian, I think something deeply miraculous happens. I think that we are changed. And yet, all of us at that point have so much further to go. To walk in the footsteps of Christ, to learn to live in that way. And we don't have to go looking for it. We can just simply pay attention. That our life offers us this classroom to learn. That it's perfectly designed for us. That we can reframe the hardships, we can reframe the difficulties, and even truly experience joy in the midst of this, like, oh, this is the work. And Jesus walks with us on that road. He accompanies us. He instructs us gently. He also is the picture of it. When we talk about the crown of life, you're talking about a prize that we strive for. And the author of Hebrews says this, since we also have this large cloud of witnesses surrounding us. I mean, talk about a family system, right? All the saints, all the Christians that have run surrounding us, let us lay aside every hindrance and the sin that so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race before us, keeping our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy that lay before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And this is just a wonderful part of the good news. That the resurrection that follows, right, puts everything in context. That the troubles that we face are light and momentary compared to eternity. That what will remain, that thing eternal, is what awaits us. This is the promise of resurrection. And so for us now in this world, James, I think, is asking us this same question. Do you want to grow? This is my longing, I think, for us as a church. I hope that when you think about why do I come to church, that doesn't necessarily need to be the top one. Maybe you're like, I love the lunch afterwards. I love my friends that are there. I love the community. I love to worship. That's great. But I do love to grow. I'm here to grow. It's why I ask questions, right? Like, what next? What do we do? Well, think about this. Sit with this. But Jesus is our model. Jesus is our vision, casting that way forward, beckoning us to follow. So here's my questions for you before we go to the Lord's table. Number one, what situations or relationships in your life are causing you to react? Or robbing you of that calm? Sit with this one. Where do you find yourself having difficulty controlling your tongue? What might lie under the surface of your anger? Is it fear, resentment, a lack of control? Disengaging for 3 months and just being on my own, like, was such a great opportunity to sit with these things. What's really going on? What are the undercurrents of my heart? Number two, are there behaviors in your life that you've justified or compartmentalized? Sins you've dismissed away as inconsequential, pride that you've justified, unforgiveness. We must not only bring these things into the light, but take responsibility for them. It's sitting with the footage of our lives and looking for all the opportunities to grow. Can we develop an appetite for that kind of truth? Truth that convicts but corrects and points us towards something more. Number three, how is God using my circumstance to create opportunities to grow? And am I willing to follow? What holds me back from leaning into these opportunities? Opportunities for grace. Opportunities to notice those that are hurting. To move towards the least of these. To find the widows and the orphans or whoever that is in your context and in your equation. How do you create space for that? Notice those people and then step in and learn. As we do, as we develop this capacity, what this brings with it is joy. A God who sees your heart and knows that you're capable of so much more, who's beckoning us to live into that, who wants to give us not just our own heart, but the heart of Christ.